there. Dad, thought Will, do something. The illustrated man, gone sweetly patient now that his blind but immensely aware dust lady was here, watched her with love.
Now,
the witch's fingers itched. Now, said Will's father loud. The witch flinched.
Now this is a fine cigar,
yelled Will's father, turning with great pomp back to the counter. Quiet, said the illustrated man. The boys looked up.
Now,
the witch sniffed the wind.
Got to light it again.
Mr. Halloway stuck the cigar in the eternal blue flame.
Silence, suggested Mr. Dark.
Ever smoke yourself? Asked Dad.
The witch, from the concussion of his fiercely erupted and overly jovial words, dropped one wounded hand to her side, wiped sweat from it as one wipes an antenna for better reception, and drifted it up again, her nostrils flared with wind.
Ah!
Will's father blew a dense cloud of cigar smoke. It made a fine, thick cumulus surrounding the woman.
Gah!
She choked.
Fool, the illustrated man barked, but whether it man or woman, the boys below couldn't tell.
Here, let's buy you one.
Mr. Halloway blew more smoke, handing Mr. Dark a cigar. The witch exploded a sneeze, recoiled, staggered away. The illustrated man snatched Dad's arm, saw that he had gone too far, let go, and could only follow his gypsy woman off in some clumsy and totally unexpected defeat. But then, in going, he heard Will's father say,
"A fine day to you, sir."
"No, Dad," thought Will. The illustrated man came back.
"Your name, sir?"
he asked directly. "Don't tell him," thought Will. Will's father debated a moment, took the cigar from his mouth, tapped ash, and said quietly,
"Halloway, work in the library. Drop by sometime."
"You can be sure, Mr. Halloway, I will."
The witch was waiting near the corner. Mr. Halloway whetted his forefinger, tested the wind, and sent a cumulus her way. She flailed back, gone. The illustrated man went rigid, spun about, and strode off. The ink portraits of Jim and Will crushed hard iron tight in his fists. Silence. It was so quiet under the grill, Mr. Halloway thought the two boys had died of fright. And Will, below, gazing up, eyes wet, mouth wide, thought, "Oh my gosh, why didn't I see it before? Dad's tall. Dad's very tall indeed." Still, Charles Halloway didn't look down at the grill, but only at the small comets of splashed red color left on the sidewalk, trailed around the corner, dropped from the clenched hands of the vanished Mr. Dark. He was also gazing with surprise at himself, accepting the surprise, the new purpose which was half despair, half serenity, now that the incredible deed was done. Let no one ask why he had given his true name. Even he could not assay and give its real weight. Now he could only read the numerals on the courthouse clock and speak to it while the boys below listened.
"Oh, Jim, Will, something is going on. Can you hide? Keep out from under the rest of the day. We gotta have time. With things like this, where do you begin? No law's been broken. None on the books, anyway, but I feel dead and buried a month. My flesh ripples. Hide, Jim. Will, hide. I'll tell your mothers. You got jobs at the carnival. Good excuse for you not coming home. Stay hid until dark, then come to the library at 7. Meantime, I'll check police records on carnivals, newspaper files at the library, books, old folios, everything that might fit. God willing, by the time you show up after dark, I'll have a plan. Walk easy until then. Bless you, Jim. Bless you, Will."
The small father, who was very tall now, walked slowly away. His cigar, unnoticed, fell from his hand, dropped in a spark shower through the grate. It lay in the square pit, glowing its single fiery pink eye at Jim and Will, who looked back, and at last snatched to blind and put it out. Chapter 36. The dwarf, bearing his demented and wildly lighted eyes, made his way south on Main Street.
Stopping suddenly, he developed a film strip in his head, scanned it, bleated, and blundered back through the forest of legs to reach for and pull the illustrated man down where a whisper was as good as a shout. Mr. Dark listened, then fled, leaving the dwarf far behind. Reaching the cigar store Indian, the illustrated man sank to his knees. Clutching the steel lattice grill, he peered down in the pit. Below lay yellow newspapers, wilted candy wrappers, burnt cigars, and gum. Mr. Dark's cry was muffled fury.
"Lose something?"
Mr. Tetley blinked over his counter. The illustrated man clenched the grate, nodding once.
"I clean under the grate once a month for the money," said Mr. Tetley. "How much you lose? Dime, quarter, half dollar?"
Bing! The illustrated man glared up. In the cash register window, a small fire-red sign jumped high. No sale. Chapter 37. The town clock struck 7. The echoes of the great chime wandered in the unlit halls of the library. An autumn leaf, very crisp, fell somewhere in the dark. But it was only the page of a book turning. Off in one of the catacombs, bent to a table under a grass-green-shaded lamp, lips pursed, eyes narrowed, sat Charles Halloway, his hands trembling the pages, lifting, rearranging the books. Now and then he hurried off to peer into the autumn night, watchful of the streets. Then again he came back to paperclip pages, to insert papers, to scribble out quotations, whispering to himself. His voice brought forth quick echoes from the library vaults.
"Look here, here," said the night passages. "This picture, picture," said the halls. "And this, this,"
the dust settled. It had been the longest day of all the days he could remember in his life. He had mingled with strange and not-so-strange crowds. He had searched after the searchers in the wake of the wide scattering parade. He had resisted telling Jim's mother, Will's mother, more than they needed to know for a happy Sunday, and meantime crossed shadows with Dwarf, traded nods with Pinhead and Fire-Eater, kept free of shadowed alleys and controlled his panic when, doubling back, he saw the basement pit empty under the cigar-store grill and knew that the boys were at hide-and-seek somewhere nearby, or somewhere, praise God, very far away. Then, in the crowds, he moved to the carnival ground, stayed out of tents, stayed free of rides, observed, watched the sun go down, and just at twilight surveyed the cold glass waters of the Mirror Maze, and saw just enough on the shore to pull him back before he drowned. Wet all over, cold to the bone, before night caught him, he let the crowd protect, warm, and bear him away up into town to the library, and to most important books, which he arranged in a great literary clock on a table, like someone learning to tell a new time. So he paced round and round the huge clock, squinting at the yellowed pages as if they were moth wings pinned dead to the wood. Here lay a portrait of the Prince of Darkness. Next, a series of fantastic sketches of the Temptations of St. Anthony. Next, some etchings from the Bizzarrie by Giovan Battista Bracelli, depicting a set of curious toys, human-like robots engaged in various alchemical rites. At 12:05 stood a copy of Dr. Faustus. At 2 lay an occult iconography. At 6, under Mr. Halloway's trailed fingers now, a history of circuses, carnivals, shadow shows, puppet menageries inhabited by mountebanks, minstrels, stilt-walking sorcerers and their fantoccini. More, a manual of the air kingdoms, things that fly down history. At 9 sharp, by demons possessed, lying atop Egyptian filters, lying atop the torments of the damned, which in turn crushed flat the spell of mirrors. Very late up the literary clock, one named Locomotives and Trains, The Mystery of Sleep, Between Midnight and Dawn, The Witch's Sabbath, and Pacts with Demons. It was all laid out. He could see the face. But there were no hands on this clock. He couldn't tell what hour of the night of life it was for himself, the boys, or the unknowing town. For in sum, what had he to go by? A 3 o'clock in the morning arrival, a grotesque-looking glass maze, a Sunday parade, a tall man with a swarm of electric blue pictures itching on his sweaty hide, a few drops of blood falling down through a pavement grill, two frightened boys staring up out of the earth, and himself, alone in mausoleum quiet, nudging the puzzle together. What was there about the boys that made him believe the simplest word they whispered up through the grill? Fear itself was proof here, and he had seen enough fear in his life to know it, like the smell from a butcher's shop in summer twilight. What was there about the Illustrated Carnival owner's silences that spoke thousands of violent, corrupt, and crippling words? What was there in that old man he had seen through a tent flap late this afternoon, seated in a chair with the words Mr. Electrico bannered over him, power webbing and crawling on his flesh like green lizards? All of it. And now these books. This. He touched physiognomy, the secrets of the individual's character as found in his face. Were Jim and Will then featured, all angelic, pure, half-innocent, peering up through the sidewalk at marching terror? Did the boys represent the ideal for your woman, man, or child of excellent bearing, color, balance, and summer disposition? Conversely, Charles Holloway turned a page. Did the scurrying freaks, the illustrated marvel, bear the foreheads of the irascible, the cruel, the covetous, the mouths of the lewd and untruthful, the teeth of the crafty, the unstable, the audacious, the vainglorious, and your murderous beast? No. The book slipped shut. If faces were judged, the freaks were no worse than many he'd seen slipping from the library late nights in his long career. There was only one thing sure. Two lines of Shakespeare said it. He should write them in the middle of the clock of books to fix the heart of his apprehension. By the pricking of my thumbs, something wicked this way comes. So vague, yet so immense. He didn't want to live with it. Yet he knew that during this night, unless he lived with it very well, he might have to live with it all the rest of his life. At the window he looked out and thought, Jim, Will, are you coming? Will you get here? Waiting, his flesh took paleness from his bones. Chapter 38. The library, then, at 7:15, 7:30, 7:45 of a Sunday night, cloistered with great drifts of silence and transfixed avalanche of books, poised like the cuneiform stones of eternity on shelves, so high the unseen snows of time fell all year there. Outside, the town breathed back and forth to the carnival, hundreds of people passing near where Jim and Will lay strewn in bushes to one side of the library, now ducking up, now ducking down to nose raw earth. "Cheese it!" both smothered in grass. Across the street there passed what could have been a boy, could have been a dwarf, could have been a boy with dwarf mind, could have been anything blown along, like the scuttle crab leaves on the frost mica sidewalks. But then, whatever it was, went away. Jim sat up. Will still lay, face buried in good, safe dirt.
"Come on! What's wrong?"
"The library," said Will. "I'm even afraid of it now." All the books, he thought, perched there, hundreds of years old, peeling skin, leaning on each other like 10 million vultures. Walk along the dark stacks, and all the gold titles shine their eyes at you. Between old carnival, old library, and his own father, everything old. Well,
I know Dad's in there, but is it Dad? I mean, what if they came, changed him, made him bad? Promised him something they can't give, but he thinks they can, and we go in there, and some day, 50 years from now, someone opens a book in there, and you and me drop out like two dry moth wings on the floor. Jim, someone pressed and hit us between pages, and no one ever guessed where we went."
This was too much for Jim, who had to do something to flog his spirits. Next thing Will knew, Jim was hammering on the library door, both hammered, frantic to jump from this night to that warmer, book-breathing night inside. Given a choice of darknesses, this one was the better. The oven smell of books as the door opened, and Dad stood with his ghost-colored hair. They tiptoed back through the deserted corridors, Will feeling a crazy urge to whistle, as he often did past the graveyard at sundown. Dad asking what made them late, and they trying to remember all the places they hid in one day. They had hid in old garages. They had hid in old barns. They had hid in the highest trees they could climb and got bored, and boredom was worse than fear, so they came down and reported in to the police chief and had a fine chat, which gave them 20 safe minutes right in the station. And Will got the idea of touring churches, and they climbed all the steeples in town and scared pigeons off the belfries. And whether or not it was safer in churches, and especially up with the bells or not, no one could claim, but it felt safe. But there again, they began to get starchy with boredom and fatigued with sameness and were almost on the point of giving themselves up to the carnival in order to have something to do when, quite fortunately, the sun went down. From sundown to now, it had taken a wonderful time creeping upon the library as if it were a once friendly fort that might now be manned by Arabs. "So here we are," whispered Jim, and stopped. "Why am I whispering? It's after hours. Heck!" He laughed, then stopped, for he thought he heard a soft tread off in the subterranean vaults. But it was only his laughter walking back through the deep stacks on panther feet. So when they talked again, it was still in whispers. Deep forests, dark caves, dim churches, half-lit libraries were all the same. They tuned you down, they dampened your ardor, they brought you to murmurs and soft cries for fear of raising up phantom twins of your voice which might haunt corridors long after your passage. They reached the small room and circled the table on which Charles Halloway had laid out the books, where he had read many hours, and for the first time looked in each other's faces and saw a dreadful paleness, so didn't comment. "From the beginning," Will's father pulled out chairs. "Please." So, each taking his part in their own good time, the boys told of the wandering by lightning rod salesman, the predictions of storms to come, the long after midnight train, the suddenly inhabited meadow, the moon-blown tents, the untouched but full-wept calliope, then the light of noon showering over an ordinary midway with hundreds of Christians wandering through, but no lions for them to be tossed to. Only the maze, where time lost itself backward and forward in waterfall mirrors. Only the out-of-order carousel, the dead supper hour, Mr. Cougar and the boy with the eyes that had seen all the glistery tripes of the world shaped like hung and dripping sins, and all the sins tenter-hooked and running red and verminous. This boy with the eyes of a man who has lived forever, seen too much, might like to die, but doesn't know how. The boy stopped for breath. Miss Foley, the carnival again, the carousel run wild, the ancient cougar mummy, gasping moonlight, exhaling silver dust, dead, then resurrected in a chair where green lightning struck his skeleton alight, all of it a storm minus rain, minus thunder. The parade, the cigar store basement, the hiding, and at last them here, finished, done with the telling. For a long moment, Will's father sat staring, blinding into the center of the table. Then his lips moved. "Jim?" "Will," he said, "I believe." The boys sank in their chairs. "All of it?" "All." Will wiped his eyes. "Boy," he said gruffly, "I'm going to start bawling." "We got no time for that," said Jim. "No time." And Will's father stood up, stuffed his pipe with tobacco, rummaged his pockets for matches, brought out a battered harmonica, a penknife, a cigarette lighter that wouldn't work, and a memo pad he had always meant to write great thoughts down on but never got around to, and lined up these weapons for a pygmy war that could be lost before it even started. Probing this idle refuse, shaking his head, he finally found a tattered matchbox, lit his pipe, and began to muse, pacing the room. "Looks like we're going to do a lot of talking about one particular carnival.
Where's it come from? Where's it going? What's it up to? We thought it never hit town before, yet, by God, look here.
He tapped a yellowed newspaper ad dated October 12, 1888, and ran his fingernail along under this.
J.C. Cougar and G.M. Dark present the Pandemonium Theater Company, combined sideshows and unnatural museums international.
J.C. G.M., said Jim. Those are the same initials as on the throwaways around town this week, but it couldn't be the same men.
No? Will's father rubbed his elbows. My goose pimples run counter to that.
He laid forth other old newspapers.
1860, 1846. Same ad, same names, same initials. Dark and Cougar, Cougar and Dark. They came and went, but only once every 20, 30, 40 years, so people forgot. Where were they all the other years? Traveling, and more than traveling, always in October. October 1846, October 1860, October 1888, October 1910, and October now, tonight.
His voice trailed off.
Beware the autumn people.
What?
An old religious tract. Pastor Newgate Phillips, I think. Read it as a boy. How does it go again?
He tried to remember. He licked his lips. He did remember.
For some, autumn comes early, stays late through life where October follows September and November touches October, and then instead of December and Christ's birth, there is no Bethlehem star, no rejoicing. But September comes again, and old October, and so on down the years, with no winter, spring, or revivifying summer. For these beings, fall is the ever-normal season, the only weather there be no choice beyond. Where do they come from? The dust. Where do they go? The grave. Does blood stir their veins? No, the night wind. What ticks in their head? The worm. What speaks from their mouth? The toad. What sees from their eye? The snake. What hears with their ear? The abyss between the stars. They sift the human storm for souls, eat flesh of reason, fill tombs with sinners. They frenzy forth. In gusts they beetle, scurry, creep, thread, filter, motion, make all moons sullen, and surely cloud all clear on waters. The spiderweb hears them, trembles, breaks. Such are the autumn people. Beware of them.
After a pause, both boys exhaled at once.
The autumn people, said Jim. That's them. Sure.
Then, Will swallowed, does that make us summer people?
Not quite. Charles Halloway shook his head. Oh, you're nearer summer than me. If I was ever a rare fine summer person, that's long ago. Most of us are half and half. The August noon in us works to stave off the November chills. We survive by what little 4th of July wits we stashed away, but there are times when we're all autumn people.
Not you, Dad. Not you, Mr. Halloway.
He turned quickly to see both appraising him, paleness next to paleness, hands on knees, as if to bolt.
It's a way of speaking. Easy, boys. I'm after the facts. Will, do you really know your dad? Shouldn't you know me and me you if it's going to be us'ns against them'ns?
Hey, yeah, breathed Jim. Who are you?
We know who he is, darn it, Will protested. Do we? Said Will's father. Let's see. Charles William Halloway. Nothing extraordinary about me except I'm 54, which is always extraordinary to the man inside it. Born in Sweetwater, lived in Chicago, survived in New York, brooded in Detroit, floundered in lots of places. Arrived here late after living in libraries around the country all those years because I liked being alone. Liked matching up in books what I'd seen on the roads.
Then, in the middle of all the running away, which I call travel, in my 39th year your mother fixed me with one glance. Been here ever since. Still most comfortable in the library nights, in out of the rain of people. Is this my last stop? Chances are. Why am I here at all? Right now, it seems to help you.
He paused and looked at the two boys and their fine young faces.
Yes, he said. Very late in the game to help you.
Chapter 39. Every night-blind library window chattered with cold. The man, the two boys, waited for the wind to pass away. Then Will said, Dad, you've always helped.
Thanks, but it's not true.
Charles Halloway examined one very empty hand.
I'm a fool. Always looking over your shoulder to see what's coming instead of right at you to see what's here. But then, for what salve it gives me, every man's a fool. Which means you got to pitch in all your life. Bail out. Board over. Tie rope. Patch plaster. Pat cheeks. Kiss brows. Laugh. Cry. Make do against the day you're the worst fool of all and shout help. Then all you need is one person's answer. I see it so clear. Across the country tonight lie cities, towns, and mere jerkwater stops of fools. So the carnival steams by, shakes any tree. It rains jackasses. Separate jackasses, I should say. Individuals with no one, they think, or no one actual to answer their help. Unconnected fools. That's the harvest. The carnival comes smiling after with its threshing machine.
Oh, gosh, said Will. It's hopeless.
No. The very fact we're here worrying about the difference between summer and autumn makes me sure there's a way out. You don't have to stay foolish, and you don't have to be wrong, evil, sinful, whatever you want to call it. There's more than three or four choices. They, that dark fellow and his friends, don't hold all the cards. I could tell that today at the cigar store. I'm afraid of him, but I could see he was afraid of me. So there's fear on both sides. Now, how can we use it to advantage?
How?
First things first. Let's bone up on history. If men had wanted to stay bad forever, they could have. Agreed?
Agreed.
Did we stay out in the fields with the beasts?
No.
In the water with the barracuda?
No.
Somewhere we let go of the hot gorilla's paw. Somewhere we turned in our carnivore's teeth and started chewing blades of grass. We've been working mulch as much as blood into our philosophy for quite a few lifetimes. Since then we measure ourselves up the scale from apes, but not half so high as angels. It was a nice new idea, and we were afraid we'd lose it, so we put it on paper and built buildings like this one around it. And we've been going in and out of these buildings, chewing it over, that one new sweet blade of grass, trying to figure how it all started, when we made the move, when we decided to be different. I suppose one night, hundreds of thousands of years ago, in a cave, by a night fire, when one of those shaggy men wakened to gaze over the banked coals at his woman, his children, and thought of their being cold, dead, gone forever. Then he must have wept, and he put out his hand in the night to the woman who must die some day, and to the children who must follow her, and for a little bit next morning he treated them somewhat better, for he saw that they, like himself, had the seed of night in them. He felt that seed like slime in his pulse, splitting, making more against the day they would multiply his body into darkness. So that man, the first one, knew what we know now. Our hour is short. Eternity is long. With this knowledge came pity and mercy. So we spared others for the later, more intricate, more mysterious benefits of love. So, in sum, what are we? We are the creatures that know, and know too much. That leaves us with such a burden again, we have a choice to laugh or cry. No other animal does either. We do both, depending on the season and the need.
Somehow I feel the carnival watches to see which we're doing and how and why and moves in on us when it feels we're ripe.
Charles Halloway stopped, for the boys were watching him so intently he suddenly had to turn, flushing away.
"Boy, Mr. Halloway," cried Jim softly, "that's great. Go on."
"Dad," said Will, amazed, "I never knew you could talk."
"You should hear me here late nights. Nothing but talk."
Charles Halloway shook his head.
"Yes, you should have heard. I should have said more to you any day you name in the past. Hell, where was I? Leading up to love, I think. Yes, love."
Will looked bored. Jim looked wary of the word, and these looks gave Charles Halloway pause. What could he say that might make sense to them? Could he say love was, above all, common cause, shared experience? That was the vital cement, wasn't it? Could he say how he felt about their all being here tonight on this wild world, running around a big sun which fell through a bigger space, falling through yet vaster immensities of space, maybe toward and maybe away from something? Could he say we share this billion-mile-an-hour ride? We have common cause against the night? You start with little common causes. Why love the boy in a March field with his kite braving the sky? Because our fingers burn with a hot string singeing our hands. Why love some girl viewed from a train bent to a country well? The tongue remembers iron water cool on some long-lost noon. Why weep at strangers dead by the road? They resemble friends unseen in 40 years. Why laugh when clowns are hit by pies? We taste custard, we taste life. Why love the woman who is your wife? Her nose breathes in the air of a world that I know, therefore I love that nose. Her ears hear music I might sing half the night through, therefore I love her ears. Her eyes delight in seasons of the land, and so I love those eyes. Her tongue knows quince, peach, chokeberry, mint, and lime. I love to hear it speaking. Because her flesh knows heat, cold, affliction, I know fire, snow, and pain. Shared and once again shared experience, billions of prickling textures. Cut one sense away, cut part of life away. Cut two senses, life halves itself on the instant. We love what we know. We love what we are. Common cause, common cause, common cause of mouth, eye, ear, tongue, hand, nose, flesh, heart, and soul. But how to say it?
Look, he tried. Put two men in a rail car, one a soldier, the other a farmer. One talks war, the other wheat, and bore each other to sleep. But let one spell long-distance running, and if the other once ran the mile, why, those men will run all night, like boys sparking a friendship up from memory. So all men have one business in common, women, and can talk that till sunrise and beyond. Hell!
Charles Halloway stopped, flushed, self-conscious again, knowing vaguely there was a target up ahead, but not quite how to get there. He chewed his lips.
"Dad, don't stop," thought Will. "When you talk, it's swell in here. You'll save us. Go on."
The man read his son's eyes, saw the same look in Jim, and walked slowly around the table, touching a night beast here, a clutch of ragged crones there, a star, a crescent moon, an antique sun, an hourglass that told time with bone dust instead of sand.
"Have I said anything I started out to say about being good? God, I don't know. A stranger is shot in the street, you hardly move to help. But if, half an hour before, you spent just 10 minutes with the fellow and knew a little about him and his family, you might just jump in front of his killer and try to stop it. Really knowing is good. Not knowing or refusing to know is bad, or immoral at least. You can't act if you don't know. Acting without knowing takes you right off the cliff. God, God, you must think I'm crazy, this talk. Probably think we should be out duck-shooting, elephant-gunning balloons like you did, Will. But we got to know all there is to know about those freaks and that man heading 'em up. We can't be good unless we know what bad is, and it's a shame we're working against time. Show will close, and the crowds go home early on a Sunday night. I feel we'll have a visit from the Autumn people then. That gives us maybe 2 hours.
Jim was at the window now, looking out across the town to the far black tents and the calliope that played by the turning of the world in the night.
"Is it bad?" he asked.
"Bad?" cried Will angrily. "Bad? You ask that?"
"Calmly," said Will's father. "A good question. Part of that show looks just great. But the old saying really applies. You can't get something for nothing. Fact is, from them you get nothing for something. They make you empty promises, you stick out your neck and wham."
"Where'd they come from?" asked Jim. "Who are they?"
Will went to the window with his father, and they both looked out, and Charles Halloway said to those far tents,
"Maybe once it was just one man walking across Europe, jingling his ankle bells, a lute on his shoulder making a hunchbacked shadow before Columbus. Maybe a man walked around in a monkey skin 1,000,000 years ago, stuffing himself with other people's unhappiness, chewed their pain all day like spearmint gum for the sweet savor, and trotted faster, revivified by personal disaster. Maybe his son after him refined his father's deadfalls, man-traps, bone-crunchers, headachers, flesh-twitchers, soul-skinners. These laid the scum on lonely ponds, from which came vinegar gnats to snuff up noses, mosquitoes to ride summer night flesh and sting forth those bumps that carnival phrenologists dearly love to fondle and prophesy upon. So from one man here, one man there, walking as swift as his oily glances, it became scuttles of dogmen, begging gifts of trouble, pandering misery, seeking under carpets for centipede treads, watchful of night sweats, hearkening by all bedroom doors to hear men twist, basting themselves with remorse and warm water dreams. The stuff of nightmare is their plain bread. They butter it with pain. They set their clocks by death-watch beetles and thrive the centuries. They were the men with the leather-ribbon whips who sweated up the pyramids, seasoning it with other people's salt and other people's cracked hearts. They coursed Europe on the white horses of the plague. They whispered to Caesar that he was mortal, then sold daggers at half price in the Grand March sale. Some must have been lazing clowns, foot props for emperors, princes, and epileptic popes. Then, out on the road, gypsies in time, their populations grew as the world grew, spread, and there was more delicious variety of pain to thrive on. The train put wheels under them, and here they run down the long road out of the Gothic and Baroque. Look at their wagons and coaches, the carving like medieval shrines, all of it stuff once drawn by horses, mules, or maybe men.
All those years? Jim's voice swallowed itself. The same people? You think Mr. Cougar, Mr. Dark are both a couple hundred years old?
Riding that merry-go-round, they can shave off a year or two any time they want, right?
Why, then, the abyss opened at Will's feet, they could live forever.
And hurt people. Jim turned it over again and again.
But why? Why all the hurt?
Because, said Mr. Halloway, you need fuel, gas, something to run a carnival on, don't you? Women live off gossip. And what's gossip but a swab of headache, sour spit, arthritic bones, ruptured and mended flesh, indiscretion, storms of madness, calms after the storms? If some people didn't have something juicy to chew on, their choppers would prolapse, their souls with them. Multiply their pleasure at funerals, their chuckling through breakfast obituaries. Add all the catfight marriages where folks spend careers ripping skin off each other and patching it back upside around. Add quack doctors slicing persons to read their guts like tea leaves and sewing them tight with finger-printed thread. Square the whole dynamite factory by 10 quadrillion, and you got the black candle power of this one carnival.
All the meannesses we harbor, they borrow in redoubled spades. They're a billion times itchier for pain, sorrow, and sickness than the average man. We salt our lives with other people's sins. Our flesh to us tastes sweet. But the carnival doesn't care if it stinks by moonlight instead of sun, so long as it gorges on fear and pain. That's the fuel, the vapor that spins the carousel, the raw stuffs of terror, the excruciating agony of guilt, the scream from real or imagined wounds. The carnival sucks that gas, ignites it, and chugs along its way. Charles Holloway took a breath, shut his eyes, and said, "How do I know this?"
"I don't. I feel it. I taste it.
It was like old leaves burning on the wind 2 nights ago. It was a smell like mortuary flowers. I hear that music. I hear what you tell me and half what you don't tell me. Maybe I've always dreamt about such carnivals and was just waiting for it to come so's to see it once and nod. Now that tent show plays my bones like a marimba. My skeleton knows. It tells me. I tell you."
Chapter 40. "Can they," said Jim, "I mean, do they buy souls?"
"Buy? When they can get them free?" said Mr. Holloway. "Why, most men jump at the chance to give up everything for nothing. There's nothing we're so slapstick with as our own immortal souls. Besides, you're inferring that's the devil out there. I only say it's a type of creature has learned to live off souls, not the souls themselves. That always worried me in the old myths. I ask myself, why would Mephistopheles want a soul? What does he do with it when he gets it? Of what use is it? Stand back while I throw my own theory over the plate. Those creatures want the flaming gas off souls who can't sleep nights, that fever by day from old crimes. A dead soul is no kindling, but a live and raving soul crisped with self-damnation, oh, that's a pretty snoutful for such as them. How do I know this? I observe. The carnival is like people, only more so. A man, a woman, rather than walk away from or kill each other, ride each other a lifetime, pulling hair, extracting fingernails, the pain of each to the other like a narcotic that makes existence worth the day. So the carnival feels ulcerated egos miles off and lopes to toast its hands at that ache. It smells boys ulcerating to be men, paining like great unwise wisdom teeth 20,000 miles away, summer abed in winter's night. It feels the aggravation of middle-aged men like myself who gibber after long-lost August afternoons, to no avail. Need, want, desire, we burn those in our fluids, oxidize those in our souls, which jet streams out lips, nostrils, eyes, ears, broadcasts from antennae fingers, long or shortwave, God only knows. But the freak masters perceive itches and come crab-clustering to scratch. It's traveled a long way on an easy map, with people handy by every crossroad to lend it lustful pints of agony to power it on. So maybe the carnival survives, living off the poison of the sins we do each other and the ferment of our most terrible regrets." Charles Holloway snorted. "Good grief, how much have I said out loud, how much to myself, the last 10 minutes?
"You," said Jim, "talk a lot."
"In what language, damn it?" cried Charles Holloway, for suddenly it seemed he had done no more than other nights, walking exquisitely alone, deliciously propounding his ideas to halls which echoed them once, then made them vanish forever. He had written books a lifetime on the airs of vast rooms in vast buildings, and had it all fly out the vents. Now it all seemed fireworks, done for color, sound, the high architecture of words, to dazzle the boys, powder his ego, but with no mark left on retina or mind after the color and sound faded. A mere exercise in self-declamation. Sheepishly, he accosted himself.
How much of all this got through? 1 sentence out of 5? 2 out of 8?
3 in 1,000, said Will. Charles Halloway could not but laugh and sigh in one. Then Jim cut across with, Is it death?
The carnival?
The old man lit his pipe, blew smoke, seriously studied the patterns.
No, but I think it uses death as a threat. Death doesn't exist. It never did. It never will. But we've drawn so many pictures of it, so many years trying to pin it down, comprehend it. We've got to thinking of it as an entity, strangely alive and greedy. All it is, however, is a stopped watch, a loss, an end, a darkness. Nothing. And the carnival wisely knows we're more afraid of nothing than we are of something. You can fight something. But nothing? Where'd you hit it? Has it a heart, soul, butt behind, brain? No, no. So the carnival just shakes a great croupier's cupful of nothing at us and reaps us as we tumble back, head over heels in fright. Oh, it shows us something that might eventually lead to nothing, all right. That flourish of mirrors out there in the meadow, that's a raw something for sure. Enough to knock your soul sideways in the saddle. It's a hit below the belt to see yourself 90 years gone, the vapors of eternity rising from you like breath off dry ice. Then when it's frozen, you stiff, it plays that fine, sweet, soul-searching music that smells of fresh-washed frocks, of women dancing on backyard lines in May, that sounds like haystacks trampled into wine. All that blue sky and summer night-on-the-lake kind of tune, until your head bangs with the drums that look like full moons beating around the calliope. Simplicity. Lord, I do admire their direct approach. Hit an old man with mirrors, watch his pieces fall in jigsaws of ice only the carnival can put together again. How? Waltz around, back on the carousel, to beautiful Ohio or Merry Widow. But they're careful not to tell one thing to people who go riding to its music.
What? Asked Jim.
Why, that if you're a miserable sinner in one shape, you're a miserable sinner in another. Changing size doesn't change the brain. If I made you 25 tomorrow, Jim, your thoughts would still be boy thoughts, and it'd show. Or if they turned me into a boy of 10 this instant, my brain would still be 50, and that boy would act funnier and older and weirder than any boy ever. Then, too, time's out of joint another way.
Which way? Asked Will.
If I became young again, all my friends would still be 50, 60, wouldn't they? I'd be cut off from them forever, for I couldn't tell them what I'd up and done, could I? They'd resent it. They'd hate me. Their interests would no longer be mine, would they? Especially their worries. Sickness and death for them, new life for me, so where's the place in this world for a man who looks 20 but who is older than Methuselah? What man could stand the shock of a change like that? Carnival won't warn you. It's equal to post-operative shock, but by God, I bet it is, and more. So what happens? You get your reward. Madness. Change of body. Change of personal environment, for one thing. Guilt, for another. Guilt at leaving your wife, husband, friends to die the way all men die. Lord, that alone would give a man fits. So more fear, more agony for the carnival to breakfast on. So, with the green vapors coming off your stricken conscience, you say you want to go back the way you were? The carnival nods and listens. Yes, they promise if you behave as they say, in a short while they'll give you back your 20 or whatever. On the promise alone of being returned to normal old age, that train travels with the world, its sideshow populated with madmen waiting to be released from bondage. Meantime, servicing the carnival, giving it coke for its ovens.
Will murmured something.
What?
Miss Foley, mourned Will. Oh, poor Miss Foley. They got her now, just like you say. Once she got what she wanted, it scared her. She didn't like it. Oh, she was crying so hard, Dad, so hard. Now I bet they promise her some day she can be 50 again, if she'll mind. I wonder what they're doing with her right now. Oh, Dad, oh, Jim! God help her. Will's father put a heavy hand out to trace the old carnival portraits. They probably thrown her in with the freaks. And what are they? Sinners who've traveled so long, hoping for deliverance, they've taken on the shape of their original sins. The fat man. What was he once? If I can guess the carnival's sense of irony, the way they like to weight the scales, he was once a ravener after all kinds and varieties of lust. No matter, there he lives now, anyway, collected up in his bursting skin. The thin man, skeleton, or whatever, did he starve his wife's, children's spiritual as well as physical hungers? The dwarf, was he or was he not your friend, the lightning rod salesman, always on the road, never settling, ever moving, facing no encounters, running ahead of the lightning and selling rods, yes, but leaving others to face the storm. So, maybe, through accident or design, when he fell in with the free rides, he shrank, not to a boy, but a mean ball of grotesque tripes, all self-involved. The fortune-telling gypsy dustwitch? Maybe someone who lived always tomorrow and let today slide, like myself. And so wound up penalized, having to guess other people's wild sunrises and sad sunsets. You tell me, you've seen her near. The pinhead, the sheep boy, the fire-eater, the Siamese twins, good God, what were they? Twins all bound up in tandem narcissism? We'll never know. They'll never tell. We've guessed, and probably guessed wrong, on 10 dozen things the last half hour. Now, some plan. Where do we go from here?
Charles Halloway placed forth a map of the town and drew in the location of the carnival with a blunt pencil.
Do we keep hiding out? No. With Miss Foley and so many others involved, we just can't. Well, then, how do we attack so we won't be picked off first thing? What kind of weapons?
Silver bullets, cried Will suddenly.
Heck no, snorted Jim. They're not vampires.
If we were Catholic, we could borrow church holy water.
Nuts, said Jim.
Movie stuff. It don't happen that way in real life. Am I wrong, Mr. Halloway?
I wish you were, boy.
Will's eyes glowed fiercely. Okay. Only one thing to do. Trot down to the meadow with a couple gallons of kerosene and some matches.
That's against the law, Jim exclaimed. Look who's talking. Hold on.
But everyone stopped right then. Whisper. A faint tide of wind flowed up along through the library corridors and into this room.
The front door, Jim whispered. Someone just opened it.
Far away, a gentle click. The draft that had for a moment stirred the boy's trouser cuffs and blown the man's hair ceased.
Someone just closed it.
Silence. Just the great dark library with its labyrinths and hedgerow mazes of sleeping books.
Someone's inside.
The boys half rose, bleating in the backs of their mouths. Charles Halloway waited, then said one word softly.
Hide. We can't leave you.
Hide.
The boys ran and vanished in the dark maze. Charles Halloway then, rigidly, slowly, breathing in, breathing out, forced himself to sit back down, his eyes on the yellowed newspapers, to wait. To wait. Then again, to wait. Some more.
This ends Disc 5. Something Wicked This Way Comes, Disc 6.
Chapter 41. A shadow moved among shadows. Charles Halloway felt his soul submerge. It took a long time for the shadow and the man it escorted to come stand in the doorway of the room. The shadow seemed deliberate in its slowness, so as to shingle his flesh and cheese-grate his steadily willed calm. And when at last the shadow reached the door, it brought not one, not 100, but 1,000 people with it to look in.
"My name is Dark," said the voice.
Charles Halloway let out 2 fistfuls of air. "Better known as the Illustrated Man," said the voice.
"Where are the boys?"
"Boys?"
Will's father turned at last to appraise the tall man who stood in the door. The illustrated man sniffed the yellow pollen that whiffed up from the ancient books as quite suddenly Will's father saw them laid out in full sight, leaped up, stopped, then began to close them one by one as casually as possible. The illustrated man pretended not to notice. "The boys are not home. The two houses are empty. What a shame. They'll miss those free rides."
"I wish I knew where they were."
Charles Halloway started carrying the books to the shelves.
"Hell, if they knew you were here with free tickets, they'd shout for joy."
"Would they?" Mr. Dark let his smile melt like a white and pink paraffin candy toy he no longer had appetite for. Softly he said, "I could kill you." Charles Halloway nodded, walking slowly.
"Did you hear what I said?"
barked the illustrated man.
"Yes."
Charles Halloway weighed the books as if they were his judgment. "But you won't kill now. You're too smart. You've kept the show on the road a long time, being smart. So you've read a few papers and think you know all about us."
"No, not all. Just enough to scare me."
"Be more scared, then," said the crowd of night-crawling illustrations locked under black suiting, speaking through the thin lips. "One of my friends outside can fix you so it seems you died of most natural heart failure." The blood banged at Charles Halloway's heart, knocked at his temples, tapped twice at his wrists. The witch, he thought. His lips must have formed the words.
"The witch," Mr. Dark nodded.
The other shelved the books, withholding one.
"Well, what have you there?"
Mr. Dark squinted.
"A Bible! How very charming! How childish and refreshingly old-fashioned!" "Have you ever read it, Mr. Dark?"
"Read it? I've had every page, paragraph, and word read at me, sir." Mr. Dark took time to light a cigarette and blow smoke toward the no-smoking sign, then at Will's father.
"Do you really imagine that books can harm me? Is naivete really your armor? Here."
And before Charles Halloway could move, Mr. Dark ran lightly forward and took the Bible. He held it in his two hands.
"Aren't you surprised? See, I touch, hold, even read from it."
Mr. Dark blew smoke on the pages as he riffled them.
"Do you expect me to fall away into so many Dead Sea scrolls of flesh before you? Myths, unfortunately, are just that. Life, and by life I could mean so many fascinating things, goes on, makes shift for itself, survives wildly, and I not the least wild among many. Your King James and his literary version of some rather stuffy poetic materials is worth just about this much of my time and sweat."
Mr. Dark hurled the Bible into a waste paper basket and didn't look at it again.
"I hear your heart beating rapidly," said Mr. Dark. "My ears are not so finely tuned as the gypsies, but they hear. Your eyes jump beyond my shoulder. The boys hide out there in the warrens? Good. I would not wish for their escape. Not that anyone will believe their gibberings. In fact, it's good advertisement for our shows. People titillate, night sweat, then come prowling down to look us over, lick their lips, and wonder about investing in our special securities. You came, you prowled, and it wasn't just for curiosity. How old are you?"
Charles Halloway pressed his lips shut.
50,
purred Mr. Dark.
51, he murmured. 52. Like to be younger?
No, no need to yell. Politely, please. Mr. Dark hummed, strolling the room, running his hand over the books as if they were years to be counted.
Oh, it's nice to be young, really. Wouldn't 40 be nice again? 40's 10 years nicer than 50, and 30's 20 years nicer by an incredible long shot. I won't listen.
Charles Halloway shut his eyes. Mr. Dark tilted his head, sucked on his cigarette, and observed.
"Strange, you shut your eyes not to listen.
Clapping your hands over your ears would be better. Will's father clapped his hands to his ears, but the voice came through. Tell you what, said Mr. Dark casually, waving his cigarette. If you help me, within 15 seconds, I'll give you your 40th birthday. 10 seconds and you can celebrate 35, a rare young age, a stripling almost by comparison. I'll start counting by my watch. And by God, if you should jump to it, lend a hand, I might just cut 30 years off your life. Bargains galore, as the posters say. Think of it, starting all over again, everything fine and new and glorious, all the things to be done and thought and savored again. Last chance. Here goes. 1, 2, 3, 4. Charles Halloway hunched away, half-crouched, propped hard against the shelves, grinding his teeth to drown the sound of counting. You're losing out, old man, my dear old fellow, said Mr. Dark. 5, losing. 6, losing very much. 7, really losing. 8, frittering away. 9, 10, my God, you fool. 11, Halloway. 12, almost gone. 13, gone. 14, lost. 15, lost forever. Mr. Dark put down his arm with the watch on it. Charles Halloway, gasping, had turned away to bury his face in the smell of ancient books, the feel of old and comfortable leather, the taste of funeral dust and pressed flowers. Mr. Dark stood in the door now on his way out. Stay there, he directed. Listen to your heart. I'll send someone to fix it. But first, the boys. The crowd of unsleeping creatures saddled upon tall flesh strode quietly forth into darkness, borne with and all over upon Mr. Dark. Their cries and whines and utterances of vague but excruciating excitements sounded in his husky summoning. "Boys, are you there? Wherever you are, answer!" Charles Halloway sprang forward, then felt the room spin and whirl him as that soft, that easy, that most pleasant voice of Mr. Dark went calling through the dark. Charles Halloway fell against a chair, thought, "Listen, my heart." Sank down to his knees, he said, "Listen to my heart. It explodes, oh God, it's tearing free and could not follow." The illustrated man trod cat soft in the labyrinths of shelved and darkly waiting books. "Boys, hear me." Silence. "Boys." Chapter 42. Somewhere, in the recumbent solitudes, the motionless but teeming millions of books, lost in 2 dozen turns, right, 3 dozen turns, left, down aisles, through corridors, toward dead ends, locked doors, half-empty shelves, somewhere in the literary soot of Dickens' London or Dostoevsky's Moscow, or the steppes beyond, somewhere in the vellume dust of Atlas or Geographic, sneezes pent but set like traps, the boys crouched, stood, lay sweating, a cool and constant brine. Somewhere hidden, Jim thought, he's coming. Somewhere hidden, Will thought, he's near. Boys? Mr. Dark came carrying his panoply of friends, his jeweled case assortment of calligraphical reptiles which lay sunning themselves at midnight on his flesh. With him strode the stitch-inked Tyrannosaurus Rex, which lent to his haunches a machined and ancient wellspring mineral oil glide. As the thunder lizard strode all glass bead pump, so strode Mr. Dark, armored with vile lightning scribbles of carnivores and sheep blasted by that thunder and a run before storms of juggernaut flesh. It was the pterodactyl kite and scythe which raised his arms almost to fly the marbled vaults, and with the inked and stenciled flash-burnt shapes of pistoned or bladed doom came his usual crowd of hangers-on, spectators gripped to each limb, seated on shoulder blades, peering from his jungle chest, hung upside down in microscopic millions in his armpit vaults, screaming bat screams for encounters, ready for the hunt, and if need be, the kill. Like a black tidal wave upon a bleak shore, a dark tumult infilled with phosphorescent beauties and badly spoiled dreams, Mr. Dark sounded and hissed his feet, his legs, his body, his sharp face forward.
"Boys?"
Immensely patient, that soft voice. Ever the warmest friend to chilly creatures burrowed away, nested amongst dry books. So he scuttered, crept, scurried, stalked, tiptoed, wafted, stood immensely still among the primates, the Egyptian monuments to bestial gods, brushed black histories of dead Africa, stayed a while in Asia, then sauntered on to newer lands.
"Boys, I know you hear me. The sign reads silence, so I'll whisper. One of you still wants what we offer, eh? Eh?"
"Jim," thought Will.
"Me," thought Jim. "No, oh no, not still, not me. Come out."
Mr. Dark purred the air through his teeth.
"I guarantee rewards. Whoever turns himself in wins it all."
Bangety bang. "My heart," thought Jim. "Is that me," thought Will, "or Jim?"
"I hear you." Mr. Dark's lips quivered. "Closer now, Will. Jim? Isn't it Jim who's the smart one? Come along, boy."
"No," thought Will. "I don't know anything," thought Jim wildly.
"Jim, yes."
Mr. Dark wheeled in a new direction.
"Jim, show me where your friend is."
Softly.
"We'll shut him up, give you the ride that would have been his if he'd used his head. Right, Jim?"
A dove voice cooing.
"Closer. I hear your heart jump."
"Stop," thought Will to his chest. "Stop!" Jim clenched his breath. "Stop!"
"I wonder, are you in this alcove?"
Mr. Dark let the peculiar gravity of a certain group of stacks tug him forward.
"You here, Jim? Or over behind?"
He shoved a trolley of books mindlessly off on rubber rollers to bump through the night. A long way off it crashed and spilled its contents to the floor like so many dead black ravens.
"Smart hide-and-seekers both," said Mr. Dark. "But someone smarter. Did you hear the carousel calliope tonight? Did you know someone dear to you was down to the carousel? Will? Willie? William? William Halloway? Where's your mother tonight?"
Silence.
"She was out riding the night wind, Willie William. Around. We put her on. Around. We left her on. Around. You hear, Willie? Around a year, another year, another. Around, around."
"Dad," thought Will, "where are you?"
In the far room, Charles Halloway, seated, his heart pounding, heard and thought, "He won't find them. I won't move unless he does. He can't find them. They won't listen. They won't believe. He'll go away."
"Your mother, Will," called Mr. Dark softly. "Around and around. Can you guess which direction, Willie?"
Mr. Dark circled his thin ghost hand in the dark air between the stacks.
"Around, around. And when we let your mother off, boy, and showed her herself in the mirror maze, you should have heard the one single sound she made. She was like a cat
with a hairball in her so big and sticky. There was no way to gag it out, no way to scream around the hair coming out her nostrils and ears and eyes, boy, and her old, old, old. The last we saw of her, boy Willie, she was running off, away from what she saw in the mirrors. She'll bang Jim's house door, but when his ma sees a thing 200 years old, slobbering at the keyhole, begging the mercy of gunshot death, boy, Jim's ma will gag, the same way, like a hairballed cat sick. But can't be sick. And beat her away. Send her beggaring the streets where no one'll believe, will. Such a kettle of bones and spit. No one'll believe this was a rose beauty, your kind relation. So, will, it's up to us to run, find, run, save her, for we know who she is. Right? Will, right, will, right, right, right.
The dark man's voice hissed away to silence. Very faintly now, somewhere in the library, someone was sobbing.
Ah!
The illustrated man gasped the air pleasantly from his dark lungs.
Yes! Here, he murmured. What? Filed under B for boys, A for adventure, H for hidden, S for secret, T for terrified, or filed under J for Jim, or N for nightshade, W for William, H for Halloway? Where are my two precious human books, so I may turn their pages, eh?
He kicked a place for his right foot on the first shelf of a towering stack. He shoved his right foot in, put his weight there, and swung his left foot free.
There!
His left foot hit the second shelf, knocked space. He climbed. His right foot kicked a hole on the third shelf, plunged books back, and so up and up he climbed, to fourth shelf, to fifth, to sixth, groping dark library heavens, hands clutching shelf boards, then scrabbling higher to leaf night to find boys, if boys there were, like bookmarks among books. His right hand, a princely tarantula, garlanded with roses, cracked a book of Bayeux tapestries, a spin down the sightless abyss below. It seemed an age before the tapestries struck, all askew, a ruin of beauty, an avalanche of gold, silver, and sky-blue thread on the floor. His left hand, reaching the ninth shelf as he panted, grunted, encountered empty space. No books.
Boys, are you here on Everest?
Silence, except for the faint sobbing. Nearer now.
Is it cold here? Colder? Coldest?
The eyes of the illustrated man came abreast of the 11th shelf. Like a corpse, laid rigid out, face down, just 3 inches away. Was Jim Nightshade. One shelf further up in the catacomb, eyes trembling with tears, lay William Halloway.
Well, said Mr. Dark.
He reached a hand to pat Will's head.
Hello, he said.
Chapter 43. To Will, the palm of the hand that drifted up was like a moon rising. Upon it was the fiery blue-inked portrait of himself. Jim, too, saw a hand before his face. His own picture looked back at him from the palm. The hand with Will's picture grabbed Will. The hand with Jim's picture grabbed Jim. Shrieks and yells.
The illustrated man heaved. Twisting, he fell, jumped to the floor. The boys, kicking, yelling, fell with him. They landed on their feet, toppled, collapsed, to be held, reared, set right, fistfuls of their shirts in Mr. Dark's fists. "Jim," he said. "Will, what were you doing up there, boys? Surely not reading."
"Dad! Mr. Holloway!"
Will's father stepped from the dark. The illustrated man rearranged the boys tenderly under one arm like kindling, then gazed with genteel curiosity at Charles Holloway and reached for him. Will's father struck one blow before his left hand was seized, held, squeezed. As the boys watched, shouting, they saw Charles Holloway gasp and fall to one knee. Mr. Dark squeezed that left hand harder, and, doing this, slowly, certainly pressured the boys with his other arm, crushing their ribs so air gushed from their mouths. Night spiraled in fiery whorls like great thumbprints inside Will's eyes. Will's father, groaning, sank to both knees, flailing his right arm. "Damn you!" "But," said the carnival owner quietly, "I am already." "Damn you! Damn you!" "Not words, old man," said Mr. Dark. "Not words in books or words, you say, but real thoughts, real actions. Quick thought, quick action, win the day. So." He gave one last mighty clench of his fist. The boys heard Charles Holloway's finger bones crack. He gave a last cry and fell, senseless. In one motion, like a solemn pavan, the illustrated man rounded the stacks, the boys kicking books from shelves under his arms. Will, feeling walls, books, floors fly by, foolishly thought, pressed close, why, Mr. Dark smells like calliope steam. Both boys were dropped suddenly. Before they could move or regain their breath, each was gripped by the hair on their head and roused, marionettes-wise, to face a window, a street.
"Boys, you read Dickens?" Mr. Dark whispered. "Critics hate his coincidences, but we know, don't we, life's all coincidence. Turn death and happenstance flakes off him like fleas from a killed ox. Look!"
Both boys writhed in the Iron Maiden clutch of hungry saurians and bristly apes. Will did not know whether to weep with joy or new despair. Below, across the avenue, passing from church, going home, was his mother and Jim's mother. Not on the carousel, not old, crazy, dead, in jail, but freshly out in the good October air. She had been not 100 yards away, in church, during all the last 5 minutes.
"Mom!"
screamed Will against the hand which, anticipating his cry, clamped tight to his mouth.
"Mom!" crooned Mr. Dark mockingly. "Come save me!"
"No," thought Will. "Save yourself! Run!"
But his mother and Jim's mother simply strolled, content, from the warm church through town.
"Mom!"
screamed Will again, and some small muffled bleat of it escaped the sweaty paw. Will's mother, 1,000 miles away, over on that sidewalk, paused. She couldn't have heard, thought Will. Yet she looked over at the library.
"Good," sighed Mr. Dark. "Excellent. Fine."
"Here," thought Will. "See us, Mom. Run. Call the police."
"Why doesn't she look at this window?" asked Mr. Dark quietly. "And see us three standing as for a portrait. Look over, then come running. We'll let her in."
Will strangled a sob.
"No, no."
His mother's gaze trailed from the front entrance to the first floor windows.
"Here," said Mr. Dark. "Second floor. A proper coincidence. Let's make it proper."
Now Jim's mother was talking. Both women stood together at the curb. "No," thought Will. "Oh, no." And the women turned and went away into the Sunday night town. Will felt the illustrated man slump the tiniest bit.
"Not much of a coincidence. No crisis. No one lost or saved. Pity. Well."
Dragging the boy's feet, he glided down to open the front door. Someone waited in the shadows. A lizard hand scurried cold on Will's chin.
"Holloway?
husked the witch's voice. A chameleon perched on Jim's nose.
Nightshade,
whisked the dry broom voice. Behind her stood the dwarf and the skeleton, silent, shifting, apprehensive. Obedient to the occasion, the boys would have given their best-stored yells air, but again, on the instant, recognizing their need, the illustrated man trapped the sound before it could issue forth, then nodded curtly to the old dust woman. The witch toppled forward with her seamed black, wax-sewn-shut iguana eyelids and a great proboscis, with the nostrils caked like tobacco-blackened pipe bowls, her fingers tracing, weaving a silent plinth of symbols on the mind. The boys stared. Her fingernails fluttered, darted, feathered cold winter water air. Her pickled green frog's breath crawled their flesh in pimples as she sang softly, mewing, humming, glistering her babes, her boys, her friends of the slick, snail-tracked roof, the straight-flung arrow, the stricken and sky-drowned balloon.
"Darning needle dragonfly, sew up these mouths so they not speak."
Touch, sew, touch. So her thumbnail stabbed, punched, drew, stabbed, punched, drew along their lower upper lips until they were thread pouch shut with invisible thread.
Darning needle dragonfly, sew up these ears so they not hear.
Cold sand funneled Will's ears, burying her voice. Muffled far away, fading, she chanted on with a rustle, tick, tickle, tap, flourish of caliper hands. Moss grew in Jim's ears, swiftly sealing him deep.
Darning needle dragonfly, sew up these eyes so they not see.
Her white-hot fingerprints rolled back their stricken eyeballs to throw the lids down with bangs like great tin doors slammed shut. Will saw a billion flashbulbs explode, then sucked to darkness while the unseen darning needle insect out beyond somewhere pranced and fizzed like insect drawn to sun-warmed honeypot as closeted voice stitched off their senses forever and a day beyond.
Darning needle dragonfly have done with eye, ear, lip and tooth, finish hem, so dark mound dust, heap with slumber sleep. Now tie all knots ever so neat, pump silence in blood like sand in river deep. So, so.
The witch, somewhere outside the boys, lowered her hands. The boys stood silent. The illustrated man took his embrace from them and stepped back. The woman from the dust sniffed at her twin triumphs, ran her hand a last loving time over her statues. The dwarf toddled madly about in the boys' shadows, nibbling daintily at their fingernails, softly calling their names. The illustrated man nodded toward the library.
The janitor's clock. Stop it.
The witch, mouth wide, savoring doom, wandered off into the marble quarry. Mr. Dark said,
"Left, right, 1, 2.
The boys walked down the steps, the dwarf at Jim's side, the skeleton at Will's. Serene as death, the illustrated man followed. Chapter 44. Somewhere near, Charles Halloway's hand lay in a white-hot furnace, melted to sheer nerve and pain. He opened his eyes. At the same moment he heard a great breath as the front door swung shut and a woman's voice came singing in the hall.
"Old man, old man, old man, old man."
Where his left hand should be was this swelled blood pudding which pulsed with such ecstasies of pain, it fed forth his life, his will, his whole attention. He tried to sit up, but the pain hammer-blowed him down again.
"Old man?"
Not old. 54's not old, he thought wildly. And here she came on the worn stone floors, her moth fingers tapping, scanning Braille book titles as her nostrils siphoned the shadows. Charles Holloway hunched and crawled toward the nearest stack, cramming pain back with his tongue. He must climb out of reach, climb where books might be weapons flung down upon any night-crawling pursuer.
"Old man, hear you breathing."
She drifted on his tide, let her body be summoned by every sibilant hiss of his pain.
"Old man, feel your hurt."
If he could fling the hand, the pain, out the window, where it might lie beating like a heart, summoning her away, tricked, to go seek this awful fire. Bent in the street, he imagined her brisking her palms at this throb, an abandoned chunk of delirium. But no, the hand stayed, glowed, poisoned the air, hurrying the strange nun-gypsy's tread as she gasped her avaricious mouth most ardently.
"Damn you," he cried, "get it over with. I'm here."
So the witch wheeled, swift as a black-clothed dummy on rubber rollers, and swayed over him. He didn't even look at her. Such weights and pressures of despair and exertion fought for his attention. He could only free his eyes to watch the inside of his lids, upon which multiple and ever-changing looms of terror jigged and gambled.
"Very simple," the whisper bent low. "Stop the heart."
Why not? He thought vaguely.
"Slow," she murmured.
Yes, he thought.
"Slow, very slow."
His heart, once bolting, now fell away to a strange dis-ease, disquiet, then quiet, then ease.
"Much more slow, slow," she suggested.
"Tired?" "Yes. You hear that, heart?" he wondered. His heart heard. Like a tight fist, it began to relax, a finger at a time.
"Stop all for good. Forget all for good," she whispered. "Well, why not?"
"Slower.
Slowest."
His heart stumbled. And then, for no reason, save perhaps for a last look around, because he did want to get rid of the pain, and sleep was the way to do that, Charles Holloway opened his eyes. He saw the witch. He saw her fingers working at the air, his face, his body, the heart within his body, and the soul within the heart. Her swamp breath flooded him, while with immense curiosity he watched the poisonous drizzle from her lips, counted the folds in her stitch-wrinkled eyes, the Gila monster neck, the mummy linen ears, the dry, rivulet, river-sand brow. Never, in his life, had he focused so nearly to a person, as if she were a puzzle which once touched together might show life's greatest secret. The solution was in her. It would all spring clear this moment. No, the next. No, the next. Watch her scorpion fingers. Hear her chant as she diddled the air. Yes, diddled was it. Tickling, tickling.
"Slow," she whispered, "slow."
And his obedient heart pulled rein. Diddle, tickle went her fingers. Charles Holloway snorted. Faintly he giggled. He caught this. Why am I giggling at such a time? The witch pulled back the merest quarter inch as if some strange but hidden electric light socket touched with wet whorl gave shock. Charles Holloway saw but did not see her flinch, sensed but seemed in no way to consider her withdrawal. For almost immediately, seizing the initiative, she flung herself forward, not touching but mutely gesticulating at his chest, as one might try to spell an antique clock pendulum.
"Slow," she cried.
Senselessly, he permitted an idiot smile to balloon itself up from somewhere, to attach itself with careless ease under his nose.
"Slowest."
Her new fever, Her anxiety, which changed itself to anger, was even more of a toy to him. A part of his attention, secret until now, leaned forward to scan every pore of her Halloween face. Somehow, irresistibly, the prime thing was nothing mattered. Life, in the end, seemed a prank of such size you could only stand off at this end of the corridor to note its meaningless length and its quite unnecessary height. A mountain built to such ridiculous immensities, you were dwarfed in its shadow and mocking of its pomp. So, with death this near, he thought numbly but purely upon a billion vanities, arrivals, departures, idiot excursions of boy, boy-man, man, and old man-goat. He had gathered and stacked all manner of foibles, devices, playthings of his egotism, and now between all the silly corridors of books, the toys of his life swayed. And none more grotesque than this thing named Witch, Gypsy, Reader of Dust. Tickling. That's what, just tickling the air. Fool! Didn't she know what she was doing? He opened his mouth. Of itself, like a child born of an unsuspecting parent, one single, raw laugh broke free. The witch swooned back. Charles Holloway didn't see. He was far too busy letting the joke rush through his fingers, letting hilarity spring forth of its own volition along his throat, eyes squeezed shut. There it flew, whipping shrapnel in all directions. "You!" he cried to no one, everyone, himself, her, them, it, all. "Funny! You!" "No!" the witch protested. "Stop tickling!" he gasped. "Not!" she lunged back frantically. "Not! Sleep! Slow! Very slow!" "No! Tickling is all it is, for sure!" he roared. "Oh, ha, ha! Stop!" "Yes, stop heart," she squealed. "Stop blood!" Her own heart must have shaken like a tambourine. Her hands shook. In mid-gesticulation she froze and became aware of the silly fingers. "Oh, my God!" he wept beautiful, glad tears. "Get off my ribs! Oh, ha! Go on, my heart!" "Your heart, yes. God!" He popped his eyes wide, gulped air, released more soap and water, washing everything clear, incredibly clean. "Toys, the key sticks out your back. Who wound you up?" And the largest roar of all flung at the woman, burnt her hands, seared her face, or so it seemed. For she seized herself as from a blast furnace, wrapped her fried hands in Egyptian rags, gripped her dry dugs, skipped back, gave pause, then started a slow retreat, nudged, pushed, pummeled, inch by inch, foot by foot, clattering book racks, shelves, fumbling for handholds on volumes that thrashed free as she scrambled them down. Her brow knocked dim histories, vain theories, duned-up time, promised but compromised years. Chased, bruised, beaten by his laugh, which echoed, rang, swam to fill the marble vaults, she whirled at last, claws razoring the wild air, and fled to fall downstairs. Moments later she managed to cram herself through the front door, which slammed. Her fall, the door slam, almost broke his frame with laughter. "Oh, God, God, please stop, stop yourself!" he begged of his hilarity. And thus begged, his humor let be. In mid-roar at last, all faded to honest laughter, pleasant chuckling, faint giggling, then softly and with great contentment receiving and giving breath, shaking his happy, weary head, the good ache of action in his throat and ribs gone from his crumpled hand. He lay against the stacks, head leaned to some dear befriending book, the tears of releaseful mirth salting his cheeks, and suddenly knew her gone. "Why?" he wondered. "What did I do?" With one last bark of mirth he rose up slow. "What's happened? Oh, God, let's get it clear.